Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, this is Kai. On our last show, we introduced you to one of the dozens of students who have gone on hunger strike as a way to illustrate the urgency of the voting rights debate in Congress. They wanted to vote, up or down, on the Freedom to Vote Act. As of this recording, that has not happened. And in fact, a number of them were arrested alongside faith leaders as they protested peacefully at the Capitol. I'm sure Fox News will shortly be calling them rioters. Anyway, with this news as backdrop, I want to share a conversation I had back in 2020 with historian Carol Anderson. We talked about her book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Dr. Anderson walked me through the long history of voter suppression in the United States and of the legislative effort to expand democracy. I think it is useful context for this week's news. Dr. Anderson, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have decades worth of history I want you to walk me through here, so there's a lot to cover. But before we do that, I'm just curious for you. I mean, how did you get started studying this? Why did voting rights and voter suppression become something that was the focus of your work?
I am a human rights scholar. I am attracted to the fractured citizenship of African Americans and how that came to be. And so the first few books really looked at that. And then came that 2016 election. And the pundits were saying, well, you know, Black folks just didn't show up. Well, they just didn't show up because, you know, they really weren't feeling Hillary because, you know, she's like, yeah. Ugh, Hillary. And it enraged me because I knew that this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. And so to have a narrative basically of Black pathology, Black folks just didn't show up, instead of really looking at the structures and the policies that made that happen, that's how I got here.
Well, let's talk about how we all got here. So we've spent a lot of time on this show talking about Reconstruction and the constitutional amendments that came out of it, including the 15th Amendment, which, to remind everybody, says that you can't stop Black men, at least, from voting. And in your book, Dr. Anderson, you detail how Southern states in particular spent the next century after the 15th Amendment finding ways to get around it, using poll taxes and literacy tests and all the rest of it, right, to keep Black people from voting without naming race or gender, for that matter. Yes. And I just want to cite a couple of the stats you used to show just how total the success was in this regard. Mm-hmm. So in 1867, 66% of Black adults in Mississippi were registered to vote. 66%. And by 1955, just 4.3% of Black adults were registered, from 66% to 4.3%. And then you point out that in Alabama, there were counties by the time we got to the 60s where there were 0% of Black people registered to vote. And I don't know that people appreciate the totality of voter suppression before the Voting Rights Act came about, or really even what the law itself set out to do about that. So can you just explain the logic and the function of the Voting Rights Act when it came about in 1965? How did it respond to the numbers that I just gave?
Absolutely. And so the Voting Rights Act was landmark because it had that pre-clearance provision. And what that did was it said you have to, states that have a history of discriminating against their citizens have to get their voting laws okayed first. What that did is it prevented these states from implementing these racially discriminatory laws, having those laws take effect, having them cauterize the electorate, having them shut down access to the ballot box so that politicians who are getting elected on these truncated, gnarled votes instead of by a full, vibrant democracy. What the Voting Rights Act did was it stepped in and said, not today, son. It said, before you go and change your requirements about what it's going to take to vote, or before you draw a line for your redistricting, before you start annexing these places to begin to diffuse the Black vote in a sea of white voters. Before you do any of that mess, you got to come through us.
And the point was, it was preventive. It was a really big part of it, right? That's what you're saying. Because there had already been, in 1957, a law that tried to stop voter suppression and didn't work out because it wasn't preventative enough, right?
It wasn't preventive at all. What it was it was about litigation. So that you think about this, you're in Mississippi and your voting rights have been denied. You have to sue. And then there's an investigation that's going to take over a year while you're Black and in Mississippi suing a white registrar. Right. And then there's a trial. And then the case, they would change the registrar or whatever, and the case would become moot and you'd have to go back all over again. So
assuming you survived all that.
Assuming you survived. So years of litigation meant that there was no change. And so that's what makes the Voting Rights Act so landmark, is because you have change.
Right. And it worked, right? I mean, this is something I think a lot of people don't also, I mean, just how rapidly it changed democracy in this country. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So in the early 1960s, for instance, there were only like 5% of Black Mississippians were registered to vote. 2 years after the Voting Rights Act, it was almost 60%. Imagine going from 5% to 60%, almost 60%.
In 2 years.
In 2 years. Wow. And you had federal electors who were going in, like in South Carolina, because South Carolina still wanted to do the literacy test. And the federal electors were like, no. And you began to see a change in South Carolina as you had federal electors there ensuring that the poll workers were not discriminating against Black citizens. That's the change. And you started seeing Black elected officials.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was it just Black voting? Is there any data that shows like what it did to voting overall and democracy overall?
Not that I know of, but I do know that with the time we get to like the 75 Reauthorization Act for the Voting Rights Act, is that they added language in there dealing with language discrimination. So part of what you see happening here is as a more thorough recognition of the barriers that are put in place in front of American citizens to stop them from voting. So it says that if you're in a county or in a region, an area that has a certain percentage of folks who speak a different language, and these American citizens have the right to vote, so you need to put your election materials in that language as well. I mean, this is how you broaden this democracy and get it vibrant.
And that's over a course of a decade.
Yeah, and that's why it was so threatening.
Yeah. Well, on the question of threatening, I mean, I think another thing I've heard you talk about that I don't think a lot of us appreciate, I didn't appreciate till I read your book, is just how rapidly white people turned against civil rights in general once Black people started voting. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my gosh. So by the time we get to we get the Civil Rights Act in 1964, that is about ending discrimination, and we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. By 65, 66, you have the majority of whites saying that we're moving too fast on civil rights issues, too fast. And this is just trying to redo the mess that happened during Reconstruction a century before. So a century is too fast. But what you also see happening here is that after that, the majority of whites have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964.
Since that time, since this law.
Yes. Yes.
You know, your previous book is called White Rage, and you talk there and other places about the idea that we understand white rage, that phrase as you use it, as only in the realm of physical violence, but that's not only or even the primary place that it shows up in American life.
No. White rage really is about the bureaucratic violence, the ways that policies and judicial decisions and laws and executive orders come down to undermine African Americans' access to their citizenship rights. And because it isn't that kind of physical violence, we often don't see it. You know, you think about it, it took the cataclysm on the Edmund Pettus Bridge for and the filming of Bloody Sunday that's cutting into nightly news programs to have people in America go, wait a minute, they're getting beaten because they're just trying to vote? Now, that it takes seeing visual violence to understand the depth of what literacy test can do, to understand the depth of what poll taxes can do, to understand the depth of what good character clauses can do. That's white rage, the policies. And that's where we are is so much today, the kinds of policies that we don't see the physical death, but we are experiencing the civic death.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me jump ahead to 1988 in our story of voting. So despite the white rage backlash, democracy does in fact expand, as we've talked about. But then the presidential election of 1988 comes along. What happened in that election in terms of turnout?
Oh, that turnout was so low. That was the Bush one. H.W. And Dukakis. And that turnout was, I think, the lowest it had been since 1924 or something like that. I mean, it's just like, so there was this kind of like, Shaggy moment of like, oh my gosh, people aren't turning out. And so you saw this movement, particularly of the Democrats, to figure out how do we expand voter registration? Because registration, if voter registration is opaque, how do you get registered to vote? And if the place where you go is only open when you're at work, I mean, all of these barriers that were there. And so they started crafting legislation, what would become the National Voter Registration Act, to open up access to voter registration with the motor voter law.
And so what did it do? I think a lot of people might know the motor voter law, at least people of my generation are familiar with that phrase. What was the motor voter law? Because it's kind of another huge deal in the story of democracy in the United States.
Yes. And what the motor voter law did was it said, you know, that instead of having to go to the Board of Elections to register to vote, when you're getting your driver's license or when you're getting your license plate, going to the Department of Motor Vehicles provides another space where you can register to vote. Wow. That opened up access. Registration went up by over a million new potential voters, as I recall, at that time. Yeah, I mean, this is no small thing. But you know, there was a poison pill in that thing, right?
Well, let's take a little break and we're going to come back and talk about that poison pill that was buried in this otherwise successful law and how we're still swallowing it now.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.
We're listening to a conversation I had with historian Carol Anderson back in 2020. She's laying out the history of voter suppression that she traces in her book, One Person, No Vote. And before the break, she told me about the 1988 Motor Voter Act, which was written to expand access to voter registration, but which also contained a poison pill that we are still living with today. What was the language that, what language was inserted in there that became a problem, and why was it there?
The Republicans insisted, as they knew that this was really going to expand the electorate, they insisted on what they called voter maintenance. And voter maintenance meant that the secretaries of state had to go through and call their list of A, people who had died naturally, B, people who had moved out of the district or out of the state. But there was a C that said, you cannot remove people from the voter rolls simply because they haven't voted. And that C got ignored, and the Supreme Court allowed it to happen.
So there it is. It sits there until we get to 2000. People hear about the 2000 election, and they immediately think about Bush v. Gore. But in terms of voter suppression, there was a whole other election, the Missouri Senate race, that became really important. Indeed. You know, the best you can remember, can you sort of give it, what happened in that race that now really changed history of voting?
Yeah, so we had this election, because again, I was in Missouri at the time. We had this election where the Governor Mel Carnahan was actually, he had died, had been killed in a plane crash, but his name was on the ballot because he died too close to it, to the election. And Ashcroft, John Ashcroft, was his Republican opponent. And in this election, the St. Louis Board of Elections had illegally removed, purged almost 50,000 voters from the rolls. And these nearly 50,000 folks didn't know it. So they show up at the polls and their names are nowhere on the books. And they get sent down to the Board of Elections downtown. Hours go by and the polls are getting ready to close. So the Democrats sue. Now the Republicans are upset because they're saying they're going to try to steal the election. They're trying to steal the election. But the Democrats are suing because people have been illegally purged from the rolls and were denied their right to vote. The judge agreed and said the polls can stay open for 3 more hours. The Republicans came in right behind with the language of voter fraud, stealing the election, and that judge shut down the polls within 45 minutes. So the polls closed at 7:45. And from there, Senator Kit Bond, U.S. Senator Kit Bond, began really riding that hobby horse of massive, rampant voter fraud.
And this is really the introduction of this idea into our political lexicon, right? I mean, it's so familiar now. But it was after that election in the Bush administration and with Republicans and senators that we first started really hearing this term, voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. And I think something I've heard you point out is that it's, you know, that the language of it was notable at the time, this idea of stealing, quote, elections in urban areas that were full of people of color.
Yes. They kept talking about, you know, this is what's happening in St. Louis. This is what's happening in Cleveland and in Philadelphia. And you get this image of urban black criminals stealing, theft from good, honest, hardworking Americans, which, as we know, is coded as white. And the problem with that narrative, there's so many problems, but one with the narrative of massive, rampant voter fraud in the cities is that it didn't exist. It just didn't exist. Kit Bond had said that there were dogs on the rolls voting. There were dead people on the rolls voting. And all of these people were using these vacant lot addresses to come back and vote multiple times using a different address. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the local newspaper, did a beautiful investigation of all of those charges and found that they didn't hold water. There was a dog on the rolls, Ritzy Meckler, right?
Ritzy gets a shout out.
Yeah, Ritzy gets a shout out. But Ritzy, nor Rin Tin Tin, nor Lassie, nor Fido voted in that election.
And but this stuck. This stuck despite this stuck. The absurdity of the facts that you're laying out, Dr. Yes. Anderson, because I mean, yes. this is literally the conversation in this election right now, that there's yes. going to be fraud.
Yes.
How did this manage to stick for now 20 years, I guess?
And I think it stuck because, one, it played to a larger vein in American society that cities are corrupt, that cities are where bad things happen. That cities that have large segments of minority populations, you can expect that crime is just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And you had an incredible PR campaign where they're in Congress testifying and using the language of voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. And so if you say a lie enough times, and you put it in the garb of respectability of U.S. senators, of big time lawyers, and you have the media that see this like flashing headline of voter fraud, voter fraud, and you don't do the kind of interrogation fully. Just stuck.
I want to jump ahead and ask you, Dr. Anderson, about 2008, there's this kind of thing I feel like amongst Black people when we start talking about voting, just about where were you when you went to vote in 2008 for Obama's first election? Where were you in 2008? What do you have a memory of that?
What I remember is I was in Missouri at the time because I taught at the University of Missouri at the time. And I remember seeing the tallies come through. And I remember looking up to the heavens and saying, "Mommy, can you believe?" wow. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I hate to pivot from something so sweet, but you've also pointed out that, you know, this moment is the next big moment in white rage in terms of how it impacted our voting. Can you say a bit about that? You feel like that it was in the sort of immediate wake of Barack Obama's election that we saw just a real resurgence in voter suppression?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so we hear this narrative that, you know, how racist can America be because we put a Black man in the White House? And that talks about how racist because white voters overwhelmingly voted for Barack Obama. But as I mentioned earlier, that's not correct because the majority of white voters have not voted for a Democratic candidate for president since 1964. What Obama had was a sizable number of whites, not the majority, but he had an incredible ground game. And that brought millions upon millions of new voters to the polls. And they were overwhelmingly African American, Hispanic, Asian American, young, and the poor. That combination would become the hit list for voter suppression.
The bill designed to respond to that voter suppression, the one that's currently unable to get a vote in the Senate, or a version of it anyway, it was already on the table back when I had this conversation with Carol Anderson. So when I asked her about solutions, about how to deal with all of this, she just pointed to that bill. But she said something else, which, you know, others have echoed since. She said, even if Congress passes this law, there's still another problem, the Supreme Court.
It reminds me of the courts after Reconstruction that gutted the 14th and the 15th Amendment, as well as the Force Acts and the Enforcement Acts, and said that the 13th Amendment's badges of servitude did not apply to Jim Crow segregation. So that's what they're setting up as a Reconstruction Court to undo and to stop progressive legislation.
That's a chilling idea.
Yeah. And I just leave it with this. Paul Weyrich, who was the co-founder of the Heritage Foundation, he said, "I don't want everybody to vote because, quite candidly, our leverage goes up as the voting populace goes down." Well, as our voting populace is going up, it's time to weaken that leverage.
Dr. Carol Anderson is author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, among other books. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you so much, Kai. Thank you.
Yo, United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Mixing of this episode by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navadar. And I'm Kai Wright. Keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And I hope you'll join us on Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream the live show at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Talk to you then.